Chapter 39, The Awakening. Hezekiah differed so entirely from his father that we must take his life to be a tribute to a good mother's influence. All we know about her is that she was Abijah, daughter of Zechariah. Throughout his childhood and up to the age of 25, he had been obliged to see the neglect and desecration of the temple and the most revolting idol worship in the holy city of Jerusalem. Perhaps he and his mother had often talked over the reforms that would come in with his kingly power, and his godly grandfather, Zechariah, had filled his mind with lofty ideas of God worship and of all the duties that would come to him as king of Judah. No sooner was he seated on the throne than he entered upon a thorough religious revival. The temple itself received the first attention. Its doors, which had been broken and disfigured, were repaired, and the precious gold decorations restored. When the outer ones, which Ahaz had closed and perhaps nailed up, were again left invitingly open, the people saw the good old days returning to Judah. Hezekiah called together a large company of priests and Levites in the wide open place on the east side of the temple. It was a memorable occasion. The king appeared before the company and spoke to them as one who was suffering with them for the past sins. He probably recalled how his father had brought Judah to the lowest state in her history. The first rule of the Hebrew people was for cleanliness. They could not approach God without first cleansing themselves and everything used in worship. "Sanctify yourselves and sanctify the house of Jehovah," commanded Hezekiah. Then followed such a time of thorough cleansing as had not been seen since the time of Asa. This much-needed cleaning occupied 16 days. 8 days to purify the workers and cleanse the temple as far as the porch, and 8 more days for the temple proper. The Levites finished their work first. The priests then removed all uncleanness which had accumulated from the inner court to the Holy of Holies. The Levites carried away the refuse and dumped it in the brook Kidron. The remains of heathen sacrifices were there and the filthiness of heathen customs. After the priests got started in this work, they undoubtedly wondered at their long tolerance of such practices in their holy temple. Unusual preparations had been made for a burnt offering and a sin offering for the Hebrew race. The occasion was made doubly impressive by an accompanying orchestra and chorus. The Levites stood with cymbals and harps, and the priests with trumpets. When the burnt offering began, the song of Jehovah began also. The day long prayed for had come to the faithful. All the assembly worshipped, and the singers sang, and the trumpeters sounded. All this continued until the burnt offering was finished. They all sang praises with gladness, and the king and all that were with him bowed themselves and worshipped. A proclamation went out for a national Passover. The king and his princes sent letters through all Judah and Israel, from Dan in the north to Beersheba in the south. "Yield yourselves to Jehovah and enter into his sanctuary," was the burden of the message. The usual 7 days of the Passover did not satisfy the enthusiasm of the people, and after consultation they entered on another week of gladness. For this additional week the king and the princes furnished the sacrifices. It was a wonderful fortnight in Jerusalem. Nothing had equaled it in the memory of anyone. The great jubilee was followed by substantial results. Idolatry and all traces of it were banished. The king called for freewill offerings, and so generously did the newly awakened people respond that the king had rooms prepared for the treasures. As they came in, the offerings were sanctified for temple use, and consecrated persons were placed in charge of them. But Judah had to turn away from the deeper delights of worship to observe what neighboring nations were about. War was the great game played by the world's rulers, and all nations had to endure the hardship. Judah had to stand her share of the worldwide uneasiness. At that time, the struggle for greatest power lay between Egypt and Assyria, and little Judah was the convenient highway between the two. There was little chance of escape from this conflict. Perhaps Hezekiah hastened a direct attack by refusing to pay tribute to the king of Assyria. This was as good as a declaration of war. As soon as Sennacherib, the new king of Assyria, could perfect his plans, he came into Judah on his way to Egypt. The fenced cities he took as a little side play and advanced towards Jerusalem. Hezekiah did all he could to prevent a long siege by concealing the fountains outside the walls and conducting the water supply into the city. He strengthened the walls, building them higher, with higher towers and stronger fortifications. But it was all in vain, and to raise the enormous tribute which Assyria exacted, he had to strip the temple doors and pillars of their gold. He bought a short time of peace. The respite was brief. Hezekiah soon received a threatening and insulting letter from Sennacherib, deriding the faith of Judah and boasting how the God of their faith would fall before his attacks. Hezekiah was alarmed and deeply offended. To buy Sennacherib off again was out of the question, and besides, that would be only a postponement. He went to the Lord in prayer and spread out the letter before him, that the unholy scorn and boasting of Sennacherib might be seen in the strong light. It would be hard to find a more striking contrast than between the pious king on his knees before God, humbly claiming the promised deliverance of those that feared him, and the rabble from Assyria running up and down outside the walls of Jerusalem, shouting their brutal threats and messages to the people on the walls and in the watchtowers. The prayer of Hezekiah was answered in the Assyrian camp. The large army was not given a chance to appear before Jerusalem. In the still night, when nothing but the sentinels' calls should have been heard, the greatest confusion and distress arose in the camp. In some mysterious way, 185,000 men perished, who were the flower of the Assyrian army. The Bible simply states that the angel of the Lord smote them. After such a severe blow, the king of Assyria could do nothing but return to his capital, Nineveh. Here a more fatal disaster overtook him. While he was worshiping the temple of his god, probably sacrificing to appease his angry god, he was murdered by his own sons. The next view we have of Hezekiah is on a sickbed. The prophet Isaiah felt that the end was near, and he came to warn the king to prepare for death. The prophet's heart was heavy, but stern duty was never shirked. The king loved life and was sad to leave his kingdom so soon. He turned his face to the wall and wept and prayed. He repented that he had become proud and too great in his own sight after the destruction of Sennacherib. The people lamented the coming loss of their king, and prayers and sacrifices went up for his recovery. What Isaiah did, we are not told. But when the Lord showed him that Hezekiah's life would be prolonged 15 years, it was with a light step that he hurried to inform the king. Besides, he revealed that God would defend Jerusalem against Assyria. What a change in the affairs of king and nation! Instead of death, followed perhaps by the taking of Jerusalem by Sennacherib, 15 years of peace were promised. To strengthen this promise, a sign was given, and the sundial of Ahaz was brought into play. This consisted of a series of steps with a staff on the top to measure time. The shadow on the dial turned back 10 steps. There was rejoicing on every hand, and Hezekiah celebrated his recovery by writing a beautiful song of thanksgiving, which is given in the book of Isaiah. Honor and riches poured in on the king. He built treasure houses for the gold, silver, precious stones, and other riches, and storehouses to hold the wonderful increase of grain and new wine and oil, and stalls for all manner of beasts and flocks in folds. In his highest prosperity, he showed the commonest weakness. The king of Babylon took occasion to send him a letter of congratulation and a royal present. This appears to have been but a pretext to hide his real design. He was seeking to form an alliance with Judah and Egypt against the stronger power, Assyria. Hezekiah felt flattered. His fame had reached even Babylon, whose king showed such interest in his recovery. He received the ambassadors in a princely way and showed them the riches of his kingdom. The prophet Isaiah suddenly appeared before the self-satisfied king. What said these men, and from whence came they, was the searching question. They came from a far country unto me, even from Babylon, answered the king half boastfully. But Isaiah's words did not encourage his pride. When he learned that they had been shown everything of value in the kingdom, he drew aside the curtain from before the future and, in turn, showed the king what would come from his mistake. The days are coming when all that is in thy house and that which thy fathers have laid up in store unto this day shall be carried to Babylon, he said. This was the first mention of the coming Babylonian captivity of Judah. Hezekiah's pride certainly caused him to blunder. The fatal result came later, but he was allowed to live and die as a successful king of Judah. The nation did him honor at his death and buried him in the ascent of the sepulchres of the sons of David.